food is love. That's the short of it. What we eat standing up at the fridge late at night or at an elaborate sit-down feast with white tablecloths and chandeliers, it all triggers emotions. We conjure up memories, good and bad. The smell and taste of the food brings us to another level of sensory decadence. Salty, sweet, tingly, bitter. And then look around the room, the ambiance, the people in our company, even the color of our plate, all of a role in what we consume and how much. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, neuroscientist. Rachel Herz studies perception and emotion. She teaches at Brown University and Boston College. Her new book, it is called Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kate. Great to be here.
Well, a lot going on in this first question, but we have to dive in somewhere. What shapes our relationship with food?
Well, pretty much everything. And the book that covers the sort of basics of all the sensory factors that go into our relationship with food and what influences how we perceive it and how much we eat. And then so the second half of the book covers all the psychological and the social and emotional aspects of how that influences our relationship with food.
So how do we know what we know about what we consume in terms of food? How do we know this?
So research from a whole variety of domains, research in sensory studies, research in neuroscience, research in social psychology, have all pitched into the answer to that question. And I've taken the answers to each of these little questions and put them together in synthesized form so that people can understand what goes into their relationship with food.
Well, taste and smell are the two senses we often associate with the food we eat. But you explain that there are many mysteries and misconceptions about taste. What are some of the common misunderstandings we have about taste?
Well, first of all, the word that we use for taste is often what we really are referring to as flavor. So when you're talking about the taste of bacon, you're actually talking about the smell plus the taste, and the aroma of bacon is really what gives it its distinctive, amazing qualities. If you're only talking about the taste, you would only be talking about salt. So salt is one of the basic tastes. So is sour, so is sweet, and so is bitter. And everything else that we perceive when we're tasting something is really about what happens with our nose and also some sensory feel receptors in our mouth. Another basic misconception is that the different tastes, that is salt, sour, sweet, and bitter, are perceived on specific parts of our tongue, what is commonly known as the tongue map, and that's totally wrong too, even though it still makes its way into textbooks. We can taste every taste sensation everywhere on our tongue and in our mouth equally. We also amazingly have taste receptors all over our body. And in fact, there are some animals that have them literally every single solitary place on their body. Octopuses are one of them. They even have them on their eyelids. But we have taste receptors inside our body in various organs. And importantly, we have them in our gut, where the food that we're ingesting, we first taste it in our mouth, and then there are also similar receptors in our stomachs that are sensing those chemicals as well.
So there's more than just what is happening on the tongue, a lot more than you know, just what we think about when we think about flavor, which is right there on our tongue. So,
right.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, the interesting thing, the reason we talk about flavor and we don't say something, and when we say taste, we really mean flavor, is because the brain knits together the sensations from smell and the taste that's on our tongue into one sensation, and because it's taking place in our mouth, we feel like it's coming from our mouth and we talk about taste. But it's because there's this synthesis in our brain between smell and taste. So we actually feel like we're smelling tastes and tasting smells.
Since we're on the tongue, we often hear that taste buds dull with age. They dull as we get older, and that impacts what we consume. Is there something to that?
Well, it's a little bit true that our taste actually does decrease with age, but much more is the fact that our sense of smell decreases with age. So starting in the mid-50s, most people's sense of smell starts to decline. Of course, it's different for everybody, just like hearing and vision loss and so on. But it is typically the case that by your mid-60s, and certainly as you get older past that, that a significant portion of the population has substantially lost their ability to smell. And because we perceive smell as this complex interaction with taste and what we call flavor. If you're eating anything that's not just salty, sour, sweet, or bitter, you're going to say this doesn't really taste the same. And, you know, I need to add, let's say, more condiments. And in particular, people do tend to add salt, which makes that aspect of what they're eating stronger, but really doesn't do anything to compensate for the smell loss.
So are people also born with different ways they approach spicy food? Some people love spicy food. They load on the hot sauce. Others steer clear of spicy food. How does that evolve?
So that's a factor relating to two different things. One is actually connected to our personality and specifically something called sensation seeking. So people who like to get lots of exciting experiences in life tend to be those who also like exciting experiences with their food. So loading on the hot sauce is one of those. And another factor has to actually do with the taste sensitivity of the person and how many taste buds they have and whether or not they're what's known as a super taster, people who have far more taste buds and who are very sensitive to all taste sensations and all oral sensations, so the creaminess of ice cream and also the sting of hot peppers, or people who have fewer taste buds and are less sensitive, people who are typically referred to as non-tasters, and they can tolerate much more heat. So you would be very unlikely to find a super taster in a hot pepper eating contest, but non-tasters who are sensation seekers are probably lining up.
There's this moment in your book you say that even putting fat on your tongue, not even swallowing it, can set up trigger things in the brain. Walk us through that.
So the feel of fat is fantastic. And we have evolved, as I'm sure most people realize, to really take pleasure in the sensation because fat has the most calories, sort of ounce for ounce, of any macronutrients. And believe it or not, in our ancestral past, we were scavenging as much as possible for as many calories as we could find. And so the feel of something fat indicates we have calories and indicates that we also need fat physiologically to maintain a whole host of different systems within us. And so the taste of fat stimulates the experience of bliss. And so the feel of that creamy sensation is something that we innately enjoy and we seek. Although sometimes in today's world, unfortunately, because we have so much fat at our fingertips, that desire for it and that pleasure can have detrimental effects.
Oh, so our line should be, I'm sorry, that just happens to be in my DNA. I can't help it.
Exactly.
Well, Americans also struggle with sweets. We know that there are huge risks with heart attack and stroke, obesity, a huge issue, where also as starvation is also a huge impact on our world. Can you explain the direct impacts and health risks involved with eating sweets, and what are strategies we should keep in mind to prevent these health risks?
So sweet, along with fat, is another taste sensation that we are programmed to love because sweet is a signal for carbohydrates. And again, when we're searching for calories, carbohydrates are really important. We definitely need them in order to survive. And so sweet is a signal for that, and we love that sensation because we need that sensation in order to survive, or we need carbohydrates to survive. But yes, sugar has a variety of health problems associated to it, as we all know. Diabetes, you know, defaulting into the fact that insulin is triggered at a high rate constantly, and that can lead to metabolic syndrome and diabetes and all sorts of other things. Obesity, it's linked, as you mentioned, to heart disease and many other ailments. But remembering the fact that we also need it, and so small amounts of sugar and carbohydrates are good for pretty much everybody. Now, one of the things that we can do, though, to avoid these tasty temptations, whether they be fatty or sweet or whatever the case might be, is to keep us at a distance from them. So one of the simplest things that you can do to avoid eating things that may not be fabulous for you, especially eating too much of them, is to move those things further away. And so believe it or not, we're actually relatively lazy inherently. This is, of course, if we're not starving and we need some food right away. But if you keep the candy bowl away from the arm's reach that you can sort of just snack on it as you're working or as you're watching television or whatever, you will eat far fewer of those snacks. So one of the very simplest things you can do is just move that stuff away so that you can't grab onto it. And instead, if you want to have something in arm's reach to snack on, put fruits and vegetables there. So very simple little strategy there. Other things that you can do are actually use different kinds of flatware and also the plates and so forth that you use to eat with. So in terms of the plates, one of the interesting things is that if you're eating a dessert, now here you're intentionally eating a dessert, and you want to augment the sort of sensation of sweetness from it, and if the dessert has any kind of pinkish quality, we want to have plates which magnify that pinkness, so to have contrast in that. And so white plates with pinkish desserts make them seem sweeter. And when we feel like we're kind of satiated on a sensation, we don't need to eat as much of it. So if the dessert tastes sweeter, you might not need to eat as much of it as if it tasted less sweet. Another tricky thing that you can do is actually use red plates or cups or bowls or whatever.
The color red.
Yes, the color red. And this is because red, actually, in nature as well as in built society, we have learned is a signal for stop or pay attention or danger, look around. And so when we see red, we automatically sort of pull back for a second and take stock. And this can both slow us down and make us realize, okay, wait a second, maybe I don't need to be eating so much. But it can also sort of act as a little bit of a wariness signal. So like, maybe, you know, I don't want to eat so much because there's a little bit of this back trigger of danger. So if you want to reduce how much you're eating, red plates are very good to use as well.
So any little thing that may slow us down, any little trigger there may help us as we figure out whether we should put that next brownie into our mouth. We're with Rachel Herz. She's a neuroscientist specializing in perception and emotion. The new book is Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How does science and food impact your life? What memories do you have of specific food, and what do those memories mean when you put a morsel in your mouth? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Rachel, how does the sweet taste affect our mood and our behavior?
So that's a great question, and it's actually the case that if you taste some sweet, you actually feel a little nicer and a little happier. And so one of the strategies, if anyone's trying to influence anyone, like if you're going to give an important talk or you're going to an important meeting, the people who bring the sweets to the meeting are always going to be better liked, and people are going to respond to you more positively than without them. So that little manipulation of bringing treats to the meeting actually does work, because when we taste sweet, we, for at least a short period of time, feel happier. And that's because of the fact that sweet triggers these bliss points in the brain, and we just feel good when we eat it. So if before thinking about, oh no, this person brought brownies and they're derailing my diet and I'm really upset about them, the feeling that sweetness induces, this feeling of niceness and happiness, actually does have this at least short-term effect on making people happier and more positively predisposed to other individuals.
So sometimes people who eat that bit of sweet, they also then crave salty, for something that is salty. What triggers this craving?
So one of the things that we're also built to want is variety. And the more different sensations there are at any given meal, the more we will eat. So Thanksgiving, which is not too far in our past experiences right now, is probably one of the classic examples of how when there's lots of different sensations of the foods around us, we will eat much, much more. So even if it was something really, really great, like something delicious that you like to eat that's sweet, so if you have like, you know, this big piece of cheesecake, and you feel like, okay, I'm finished with that, and if that's all that's there, that's completely fine. You're not going to take another slice of cheesecake. But if I then bring out some delicious savory dish that you're feeling like, oh, I'd just love to have just at least a taste of that, you are most likely going to go for it unless you're too painfully full, because we love to have a lot of variety. And when we see variety is a good thing, because from a ecological standpoint and in terms of the biology of our system, we do want macronutrients from a variety of different foods. It's not good only to be eating one thing. But this can go a little awry again when the variety is too assorted and too high calorie and filled with other things that may not be so good for us. But if you also want to rein yourself in from the point of view of eating too much, if you eat monotonous meals, so like if you just made chili every night for a week and that was your dinner, you would eat much less of that than you would if you had a meal with multiple different, you know, foods in that meal.
We're learning about the science of what we eat. Even the feeling, as we mentioned earlier, fat on the tongue lights up the reward and emotion centers of our brain. Neuroscientist Rachel Herz is with us. Her new book is Why You Eat What You Eat. Your questions about the science behind what we choose to consume at 800-642-1234. How would you describe your relationship with food? What strategies do you resort to help you keep your health and diet on track? In what ways has your relationship with food challenged you? And what memories of food carry over from your childhood? 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back after in just a moment. Our choices about what we eat are definitely driven by conflicting impulses, and we use all of our senses in developing this lifelong relationship with food. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With New Year's resolutions related to food on our mind, we're exploring our complex relationship with food. Neuroscientist Rachel Herz's new book is Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a picky eater? What food cravings do you often have? How do you resist them? What goals do you have in mind this year for your diet and your relationship with food? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at mornings at WPR. Let's go to Jane in Partyville. Hi, Jane, go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Several years ago, I was hospitalized and had some surgery, and as the result of the surgery, I was not able to eat food for about 23 days. I was eating ice chips, and when I was able to eat food again, everything tasted awful, and it almost tasted like everything was spoiled, and that went on for almost a week, and then the sweet taste came back, and that turned me into a horrible sweetaholic, but eventually I did get my taste back, and I was wondering if it's one of those use-it-or-lose-it situations.
So that's a really interesting question. So I don't know of that specifically, and it may have been partially connected to the drugs that you were taking, potentially post-surgery or other sorts of aspects of the surgery that potentially for a period of time influenced your sense of taste, because it's certainly the case that different medications can influence our sense of taste and also possibly something that took place during the surgery. So that is more what I would suggest. However, it's also the case that when people, for example, diet and cut out one of the tastes, let's say they want to stay completely away from sugar as much as possible, they then find when they taste something sweet that it's much more intense to them than it had been formerly. So there is this kind of contrast effect in terms of our experience. So not being able to taste something or deliberately not having that sort of taste in your diet for a while will then make that sensation more intense when you bring it back.
Jane, thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Lynn now in Racine. Hi, Lynn, go ahead.
Good morning, ladies. I was curious. Rachel mentioned that if you eat from a red plate, it might, you know, send you a signal to say, red, stop. But I am familiar somewhat with a program for the elderly, for dementia patients, called the Red Plate, where they actually say that giving these patients a red plate with their food on it will encourage them to eat. Has she heard of this? And I'll take my answer off the air.
I actually have not heard of that, and that's actually sort of surprising to me because there is a fair bit of research showing that if you're trying to get people to eat, so encouraging, for instance, people who are in the hospital recovering from something where they don't feel like eating, and your example of the elderly is another really good one, that it's not at all a good strategy to use red. In fact, if you're going to use any color, yellow would be the one to choose because of its sort of happy connotations and associations. The only thing I can think of, and this is not because of research, but just because it, you know, whatever might make sense with respect to red, is that it might draw their attention to the food and therefore orient them to sort of think about eating, because one of the things that happens to the elderly, especially if they live alone, and because we're losing our sense of smell as we age, that the cues to eat, let's say, you know, the aroma of something cooking, isn't driving you to want to eat. And maybe if you have a visual cue that's reminding you to eat, then that might help. And that may be why red, because it's very attention-getting as a color in and of itself, that might be why it's used. But certainly if you're dealing with someone who does not want to eat or is having problems with consuming sort of, you know, directly saying to you, no, I don't want it, do not use red when you're presenting food to them.
Your book got me thinking yesterday about the relationship I have with drinking hot tea during this show, and I realized that if it's going to be a political conversation, I immediately drop in the tea bag that's Earl Grey, which is caffeinated and bitter. Last hour, we were talking about the environment, and my impulse was to go for a minty, it was called Northwest Minty Tea. What does our environment and the company we keep in terms of the conversation, even perhaps the people around us, what does environment have to do with what we consume?
So that's a huge question that has lots of different answers. But to go to your tea example specifically, I think it's really interesting what you're saying and how you choose the different types of teas, because it seems as if it reflects the mood and the tenor of the conversation. So it's almost like you have a congruence between your tea when you're talking about something sort of testy and you know, sort of maybe alarming. You're using bitter, which is sort of a non-pleasant sensation, something also that's going to keep you alert, sort of the sort of sensation of, let's say, Earl Grey tea. It's kind of alerting and, as you said, caffeinated. Whereas if you're talking about something like the environment, you're choosing a tea blend, it sounds like, that really is kind of reflecting nature, sort of minty and floral and herbaceous and so on. And so that seems to me potentially why you're choosing those, to kind of complement your mood or augment the mood of the conversation you're having. But there's also the case that when we, for instance, are feeling upset or distressed about something, let's say politically, that people often turn to comfort foods because something like that can make them feel better and more soothed. It's also the case that the number of people that we're with influences how much we eat, and the more people that are with us, the more we eat, unless they're complete strangers, in which case sometimes we sort of reserve ourselves. It's also the case, potentially, that if you're eating in front of someone you want to make a good impression to, like a future boss, we also restrain ourselves. And so there's all kinds of different aspects about how the immediate environment and also maybe what you're thinking about thematically in terms of the conversation you're having might be influencing what you choose to consume.
Okay, so do comfort foods, going back to the first thing you said, do comfort foods do the trick? Do they really soothe?
They really do soothe. The issue is to not over-soothe ourselves, as it were. So comfort foods soothe us in at least two ways. One is that they are foods that we eat and we were given when we were in times of feeling a little bit blue. So foods that are associated with childhood, that our parents made for us when they were, let's say, going out for the evening, and here's, I'm going to make you some mac and cheese, or maybe you had a bad day at school, and, you know, here's this plate of chocolate chip cookies and a glass of milk. So those foods specifically connected to times when we were being taken care of and soothed by our primary caregivers are foods that definitely end up in the comfort food category, and we go to them when we are feeling kind of blue or distressed and so on. The other aspect is that these foods are high in usually fat, carbohydrate, and other positive sensations. Both salt and sweet are positive sensations. And because these positive sensations are positive in and of themselves, so like I mentioned earlier, we're kind of wired to enjoy them, we get this sort of hedonic high just by tasting them. So the sensation gives us a positive boost, and then their associations also give us a positive boost. But really interestingly, people who have especially good relationships, that is, if they were brought up, this is to do with their attachment style, so if they were brought up in loving, secure family homes, and they have, you know, good, confident, trusting relationships with other people, they tend to actually go to those comfort foods like the chocolate chip cookies and milk or the mac and cheese more than people who don't have such good, stable relationships with other people. Because for the well-connected people, those foods really are like a warm hug from their family. Whereas for people who don't have quite that same connection, the foods are really more acting like that just feels really good, or maybe you have something special connected to it, but it's not quite the same.
Hmm. Jim from Cedarburg sent us an email. He says, do you have any advice on weaning someone who suffers from depression? Are there foods you can recommend, perhaps a diet or a program as you cope with depression?
So I don't want to sort of, you know, start walking into areas where I'm really not an expert, so I'm not an expert in depression at all or in psychiatric conditions. But it is certainly the case that healthier diets, and in fact, even though for a long time it was believed that carbohydrates were good for people were, you know, for depression, people were self-medicating by eating, you know, donuts and bread and pasta, and that was because of the release of serotonin from eating those foods and the connection with depression and so on. It's really actually been more recently shown that eating just a lot of carbohydrates is not good for mood in the long term. So the key is really moderation and variation. So having moderation, and you can eat anything you want, but not too much of it, and having a variety of different kinds of foods. So you want to eat fruits and vegetables, you want to eat nuts, you want to eat protein, you want to eat whatever the case might be, but you want a variety of those different macronutrients in your diet, and you don't want to just focus on, let's say, bread and pasta, because in the long term that will not be effective for depression.
What does the color of the food on our plate have to do with what we consume?
So the color of the food is also a signal for its ripeness, for example, and also could potentially be signals for how salty or not it is. And especially going back to the concept of red, this is sort of a little bit, red has sort of, in a way, kind of conflicting information associated to it, because when fruit is red, we know from experience that it is usually means that it's riper and therefore sweeter. And that's why red can also be sort of an augmenter for the sensation of sweetness. So when we see, depending on what the food is, especially in the fruits category, something being brighter colored or redder, we tend to think of it as being more sweet. If the food, for instance, in the same category of fruits is, let's say, more green, we think of it as being more sour. And the really interesting example is as grapes, because we have red grapes and we have green grapes. And they, if you were blindfolded, you would probably perceive them as being equally sweet. But if you have, you know, looking at them, we tend to think that the green grapes are going to be a little bit sour, and we therefore perceive them as sour, more sour than the red grape, even though they're probably identical in sweetness.
And there are scientific studies that prove this.
Yes.
Wow. I mean, that to me is really pretty remarkable that our brain can do such tricks on us when it comes to food, because we absolutely need the nutrients to stay alive.
Yeah, it's amazing what our brains can do. I mean, it's really a question of mind over matter in so many different ways. So the example of just what our eyes are telling us and what we think we're going to be perceiving, even how food is arranged on the plate. So if food is arranged in a nice kind of artistic way, or we feel like the presentation is appealing, we think the food tastes better. Another really interesting thing is how labels influence us. And this is especially insidious in, let's say, the wine drinking world, where if you put a label of, you know, a Grand Cru, and you make it seem as if this wine is really special and sophisticated, people will think that wine tastes much better than that exact same wine bottled in something nondescript. And this fools even wine connoisseurs and wine experts when you do this kind of thing, or if you present like this costs much more than something else, people will think it's much better. It's also the case that when we see labels that say low fat or low calories, believe it or not, our bodies slow down when we metabolize those foods, so we actually burn fewer calories than if we were to see labels that say indulgent and decadent. And this is irrespective of how many calories are actually in the food. So if we could trick ourselves into not thinking that low calorie or low fat was actually low calorie and actually make us think that it's decadent, we would actually burn more calories consuming it. And it's actually a good idea to steer clear of these kind of low-calorie, low-fat, and foods that promote the concept of health, or even foods which sort of label themselves, or at least be aware of the fact that when foods are labeled organic and fair trade, that that might also seduce us into eating more, because we have this conflation with the idea of health and low-calorie, even when that's not the case. So people will think that organic Oreos, for example, have fewer calories than conventional Oreos and eat more organic Oreos, even though the calorie content is the same. So just being aware of all these little influences is really important.
So Rachel Herz, you're saying that our metabolic systems can change and adjust based on the labeling we read on specific items at the grocery store?
Yes, it's pretty fantastic. So this was a research that was done by Alia Crum, who showed that these placebo effects, kind of mind over matter, work with just labels alone. In her research, she used a milkshake that there were two different milkshakes. Actually, they were the identical milkshake in terms of calorie and everything else. But in one situation, they were labeled as indulgent and decadent, and it was, you know, this is a splurging calorie milkshake. And in another situation, that exact same initial, like, or original, the ingredients in the milkshake were exactly the same, but they were labeled with sensible, low calorie, and so on. And when people consumed, the same exact people consuming these same exact milkshakes, when they consumed it with the label that said high calorie and decadent, they burned more calories, their metabolism went up, than when they consumed it with the low calorie labels. And in fact, in the low calorie labels, nothing happened. The body was just kind of at stable standstill. And so this really shows that this is totally independent of the calories in the food. When we believe something is really decadent and high calorie, we actually rev up our metabolisms to consume it.
Willpower is part of our food equation. Turns out our capacity to take on a lot of mental challenges can only go so far. If we're channeling a lot of our mental energy towards certain tasks like work, we're less likely to show similar discipline in other areas of life, like our diet. Neuroscientist Rachel Herz stays with us. Her new book is Why You Eat What You Eat. She teaches at Brown University and Boston College. Your food-related questions and perceptions are welcome at 800-642-1234. In what ways has your relationship with food been challenging? How has it evolved? Are you or someone you know a picky eater? What do you want to know about an affinity for spicy food, or do you steer clear of the hot sauce? 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back in just a moment. We also learned that sound apparently has an impact on her relationship with food. We're talking with neuroscientist Rachel Herz on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. She writes about a fancy restaurant in England that serves up a dish called Sound of the Sea. The meal comes with an iPod hidden in a conch shell with earbuds. You listen to sounds of waves lapping on a shore, seagulls squawking, and the dish looks like a sandy beach. This sensory immersion would clearly do a number on our impression of the food and the restaurant. The new book is Why You Eat What You Eat. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. When did you have a major sensory experience with food? Has food brought you to tears before? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rachel, have restaurants become very aware of the experience with food and what the sight and sounds that they can bring into the restaurant?
So some restaurants certainly have. I don't think that all restaurants are taking advantage of all the things that they can in terms of the sensory environment around them. But Heston Blumenthal, who is the chef who runs the Fat Duck, which is the restaurant you're referring to, which has this dish called The Sound of the Sea, certainly knows about this issue and how there's something called sensory transference, how when you experience something in one sensory domain, it can transfer to another. So when you're hearing the sounds of the sea and then you're seeing something also that looks like a seashore, what you eat is going to be mediated through that, and you're going to perceive that to be exactly like the visual and the auditory perceptions that are around you. And so this dish, which is a complex dish and obviously as is seafood related, is very much augmented by how it looks and how it sounds. And it's also the case, and this is kind of connected to your point about Earl Grey tea or the herbal tea, that the memories and associations that are brought back by, for instance, hearing the lapping waves or seeing what looks like a seashore can actually really combine with the sensation that's coming from smell and taste and bring people back, bring them all kinds of memories, take them back to their childhood. And I have read that people have been moved to tears sometimes being presented with this dish with all of its sort of sensory enhancements.
Let's go to Sharita, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Sharita. Go ahead.
Hi. I think this is an awesome discussion. I have a client that is a geneticist here in Madison. He's basically doing trials based off of his parents' experiences and their illnesses, basically putting a template together that will help people base their diets and kind of channel their nutrition based on their genetic code, which is kind of crazy. If you can take your genetic code and kind of whittle it down to what your body actually needs, will kind of transform kind of how people survive almost. So it's pretty awesome, and this is a really cool concept.
Well, Sharita, thanks for bringing that to the table. Rachel, what do you make of that?
Well, actually, this is a burgeoning field, a kind of like, you know, that there's precision medicine where when we have your genetics, we know what kinds of medications to give you, how much, and so forth. And there are companies like obviously this caller's client who are developing the same kind of techniques for understanding food metabolism and understanding how that might also affect the body. And so kind of applying precision medicine to precision menus. And I think this is something which is just in its beginning. And I think this is something that's going to have a larger and larger impact as we use our genetic codes more in our daily life.
Sharita, thanks for the call. Let's go to Karen now, who joins us from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. My question is, for the folks that live in the colder climates where they're shipping our food from, say, California, Florida, what's the best avenue if, you know, you enjoy fruits and vegetables, and but, you know, the stuff at the store just looks less than fresh, at this, especially this time of the year, winter times? What do you suggest that we do, buy frozen, or can you kind of walk us through that just for a typical good diet?
So, in general, it's the case that frozen food is, especially in the fruits and vegetables camp, is much better than canned. So if you don't have access to real, fresh, local produce, then buying it frozen is better than buying it canned. But you can also probably, even in colder climates, work with greenhouses and find places that are actually still growing things currently and get fresh produce in that way, although it's often more expensive.
Karen, thanks so much for the call. Rachel, a lot of people are grappling with their New Year's resolutions. Many of these resolutions have to do with food. What does our willpower have to do with this and our capacity to change what we eat and the mental challenges associated with it?
So willpower takes effort, and it really does use up a lot of mental energy. And so that is to say, our brains have to really be focused and attentive and reminding us and sort of being on top of us if we want to resist what we crave to eat. And so when we are doing something that is also mentally taxing, and you mentioned this earlier, when we're doing something else that's also really mentally taxing, it's a lot harder to also exact that willpower to stop us from eating the donut in the break room or whatever the case might be. So it's important to understand that there are these sort of balances we have to keep in mind, and that if we want to not set ourselves up for failure, then if we're doing something that's really mentally engaging and taxing from a work perspective, we should probably also maybe avoid the temptation in the first place. So if you know that there are donuts in the break room, don't walk into it then while you're also working on something really complex. But if you are in a sort of more relaxed state of mind, if there isn't as much going on, you will be able to overcome, you know, some temptations when they're in front of you if you have the willpower, you know, in your mind that you want to.
Let's go to Kelly now, who joins us from Whitewater. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I know you're talking about food, but can we talk about hot tea?
Hot tea, yes. I'm drinking it.
Oh, good. I am really, really, really in love with hot tea, and I was wondering why that would be.
So I'm not exactly a tea expert, but I can give you sort of a little bit of a psychological or sensory answer to that question. And that's potentially because, first of all, hot tea is, as you say, hot. And when we are holding a warm mug, that actually makes us feel warm and good. And people are actually feel more comforted. They're in fact, more positive to other people when they're holding warm beverages than if you were holding a cold beverage. So the warmth from the teacup itself is actually impacting your mood. And also, depending on the degree to which you're sensitive to caffeine, tea actually contains a compound called theophylline. It's similar to caffeine, but not identical. And if you're someone who gets really agitated, for instance, drinking coffee, tea can be more calming or certainly less agitating, even though it can still make you feel alert if you're drinking the kind of tea that has caffeine, but it's really theophylline in it. And so those are factors which can sort of go into your experience. And also, if you're the fact that teas have so many different kinds of flavors and varieties, we can sort of be more adventurous with the different sensations we're getting from teas when we feel like it. So if you're feeling like you want this sort of mountain blend, you can have that. You can have green tea. You can have different black teas. You can have white teas. So there are all these different sorts of experiences we can get from tea at a sensory level, from the taste and the aroma, as well as the fact that we have the warmth of the tea and we have the stimulation without maybe overstimulation, depending upon how sensitive you are to the compounds in it.
Kelly, thanks so much for the call. Mary from Butternut wants to know, if you cut way back on salt, supposedly the food tastes better. But for me, Mary says, food completely loses its flavor when I do this. Since it was supposed to improve its flavor, why does it seem like food loses its flavor when I cut the salt? I didn't want to eat anymore because I didn't like how food tasted after removing the salt from my diet.
So there's something, so first of all, it depends on how long you go through with a salt diet. And there have been quite a lot of studies which have really shown that although it is really hard at first and food will not taste good to you initially, if we wait a while, let's say around 3 months of putting yourself on the salt diet, now, not that that's the most pleasant thing, you will be actually much happier and much more positively predisposed to the current level of, let's say, low salt in your food. And if you were to taste what you used to really like, you would actually find that unpleasant. So there is the case that you have to kind of stick with it, and initially it's not going to seem as if the food tastes very good without salt. And we do actually, especially people who use a lot of salt, it is a really positive sensation. We really like the taste of salt, and therefore it's part of what really makes food pleasurable, and cutting back on it is unpleasant. But you just have to kind of go through with it. And another thing, though, is that if it's Mary, I think your name is, are talking about flavor, it's possible that you're actually not getting as much from the aroma of the food as you might think you are, and the salt is compensating for that. And so with less salt, you're actually just getting less sensation overall, and that maybe it would be important to look into your sense of smell and see if that's functioning normally, and maybe there's some things that can be done to help you with that.
Rachel, at the end of the day, how much control do we have over what we eat?
So what I'm hoping is that my book gives you control, because there are so many influences, from the sensory aspects of the food to the cutlery and the plates we use to the social environment we're in to our emotions and our memories and our mood states and everything else that go into it. Then my hope is that my book gives people that information so they can go, aha, that's why I feel this way, and with that information be able to take control back.
But what if we don't have the time to think deep thoughts about what we put in our mouth? What if we're eating in front of the fridge and we're running out the door?
Well, see, that's one of the things I talk about in my book. So distracted eating is another big problem. So we want to be able to, even if you're eating in front of the fridge, say, okay, wait a second, what am I eating? And how does it taste? And how do I feel? And why did I reach for that and not that? And I think we all have a split second to be able to engage in what we're eating and not just be mindless. Even if you're running out the door, you can still sort of take stock of what you're consuming and think about it for a second to sort of figure out why you chose that, how you're eating it, and if you really want to be eating that, or maybe you want to eat something else. And over time, I think if we just take little baby steps of doing this, we'll start thinking about our food more and realizing all the things that might be affecting us for making that choice, and that might change our relationship with food.
Will that change our mood, our behavior, our psychology, our being?
I believe so. I think that the more we take stock of what we eat, the more we take stock of everything that's around us, and that can give us a better quality of life and better relationships with everything.
Okay, so what is the first step? What can we do today to change our relationship with food?
Read my book and learn all the things that are influencing you, so from labels to social environment to the colors and so forth. But I would say most importantly, first of all, give yourself a break and say, you know, the mantra that I like, as I mentioned already, sort of moderation and variation. So you can have it, just, you know, don't have too much of it necessarily, and make sure that there's variety in your diet. And just sort of think about it when you're eating. So look at the food, smell the food, hear the food if it makes a sound, look at the things around you, look at the labels, look at what's going on, and don't be distracted while you're eating that. Even if you just do it, like I said, for a couple of seconds, you will start to take stock of what's going on in the world around you and in your relationship with the food, and then start to realize the things that you could maybe change, or how you're actually experiencing the food. Does this really taste, is this really, really pleasurable for me? Or maybe this is just what I always eat, and therefore I'm just going for it by default. And maybe I should actually eat something else, or I might even get more enjoyment out of something else. So just thinking about it.
As we begin to wrap up here, Rachel, there are forces in our life, as you have told us this hour, our DNA, companies getting wiser about their marketing and their advertising to us about food. Do we need to become better informed as we approach food, and also how high-tuned our bodies are to respond to different influences that food bring to our lives?
Well, absolutely. So the more informed we are, the more power we have. And the idea here is that, you know, knowledge is power, and what we can find out about all the influences that go into what we choose to eat gives us the power back, so that when we eat, we're doing it as we want to, the way we want to, and that will just make everything about our relationship with food more positive.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being here. It was really great.
It was great to talk to you, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Rachel Herz is a neuroscientist specializing in perception and emotion. She teaches at Brown University and at Boston College. She's the author of several books, including her new one. It's titled Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Niaja Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this conversation about the science of food, you find it on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for listening.